spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil, olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generations.
The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, written by Hannah Grad Goodman, is entitled The Dragon's Tale and is presented in honor of Memorial Day.
It may be that Louis Alexander Slotin heard the Geiger counter ticking long before the rest of the world. Perhaps even when he was a child, the Geiger counter was ticking for him, slowly, faintly, but surely, marking the hours, the days, the years, which led inevitably to that afternoon of May 21st, 1946, in the atomic laboratory in Los Alamos. While the small boy who would someday be Dr. Louis Slotin played and studied and pondered in the city of Winnipeg, Canada, his destiny was sounding. Those factors which would make him what he was to be had already been set in motion.
And in the Talmud it is written, Louis, only he is master of himself who lives for God and men. He is free from the power of sorrow, free from the oppressor's yoke, free from death.
Only he is master of himself, who lives for God and men.
I do not expect you to understand this yet, Louis, but remember it. Someday it will have meaning for you.
He is free from sorrow, from oppression, from death. I think I understand it now, Papa.
I think you do.
Louis! Louis, are you there? Albert, where's Louis?
He isn't home yet.
Mr. Tussman is here to give the boys their Hebrew lesson.
Look, maybe he's in his room. Louis, you've been here all the time.
Oh, what, Papa?
Didn't you hear your mother calling you?
Papa, I was looking at these stones. See how they're rounded? They must be very old.
Your mother has been calling you for 10 minutes, Louis, from the very next room.
I didn't hear her. I was concentrating.
Louis, such a concentration I have never seen. It is as if all the powers of your being are gathered into your small head, shutting out the rest of the world. Come, your brother Sam and the Feinstein boys are already here with Mr. Tussman waiting for you. I want to hear again how nicely you talk Hebrew.
What are you doing with the little boats, Louis?
Mama, yesterday I was watching the sailboats. The sailboats were moving against the wind.
So?
How can the sailboats move against the wind?
I don't know. I never thought of it. That is why you're playing with the boats, Louis?
I'm trying to find out the answer, Mama. Papa, why does the sun shine?
Because it is on fire.
But why is it on fire?
Well, the sun is on fire because it is burning.
Why doesn't it burn up?
It doesn't burn up because... Louis, the sun shines. Huh? So it shines. That is enough for us.
But I have to know why it shines.
You have to know why?
Yes. We all have to know why, don't we?
Louis, you'll be in school tomorrow. You'll ask your teacher, huh? Now, go out in the good sunshine and play in it.
I want to look in this book, Papa. Maybe it's in this book.
Why do you have to look in the book now, Louis, when you can ask the teacher?
I have to find out for myself.
Yes, the Geiger counter was already ticking for the small boy, Louis Slotin, as he pondered the mystery of the sun and its energy, source of all life. Later, in the climactic moment of his life in the laboratory at Los Alamos, he would again probe the vast primary sources of the universe's energy. For the world knows now that the source of solar energy is nuclear reaction, and the sun is a gigantic nuclear furnace, a self-regulating hydrogen bomb. Louis Slotin's consuming scientific curiosity and his search for truth brought him at 15 to the University of Manitoba, where 6 years later he obtained his Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degrees.
Congratulations, Louis. Congratulations, Mama.
Oh, this is a wonderful day, Louis. You have your Master of Science degree.
With honors. I'm glad you're so happy.
Oh, I was so proud when I saw you standing there, Louis, in your cap and gown. The youngest, only 21, and when they said with highest honors.
They were good years. I think I learned a lot.
And now, Louis, what will you do with all this knowledge, huh? What are you planning?
I don't have too much knowledge. I've been thinking about it, Papa. You know what I want to do?
Study more?
Yes, in physics. I'd like to go to the University of London and get my doctorate there.
London? How long will this take?
4 years.
4 more years?
How do you feel about my going, Papa?
You will have a wonderful 4 years, Louis.
And so it was that in 1936, at the age of 26, Louis Slotin received his Doctor of Philosophy in Physics from the University of London, graduating magna cum laude. On his return to Winnipeg, he stopped off at the University of Chicago, where he met the distinguished physical chemist, Professor William D. Hawkins, a pioneer in the field of atomic research.
Professor Hawkins, I've read your papers on nuclear transmutation. They are very exciting.
Well, thank you, Dr. Slotin. Won't you sit down?
Thank you.
Yes, we've made some progress. We're just finishing the building of our new cyclotron.
A cyclotron? That should be useful in producing new isotopes.
And even more important in our atom-smashing experiments. We come closer to an understanding of nuclear forces daily.
I see. Professor?
Yes?
How large is your present research group?
Not large enough. As usual, we're hard-pressed for money for our experiments.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yes. Yes, slows us up. For example, I need an assistant to work on the cyclotron.
Oh?
But there isn't a penny for salary.
I'd like to work on that with you.
You're exactly the person I need. I wish I could offer you the job. But it would have to be at the attractive salary of exactly nothing per week.
I'll take it.
Louis Slotin spent 2 years with Professor Hawkins at the salary of exactly nothing per week. And his achievements in research with the cyclotron led him directly to the top-secret atomic project, the Manhattan District. For the country was now at war, and the world's greatest scientists were racing towards completion of an awesome new weapon, the atomic bomb. The Geiger counter was ticking loudly as Louis Slotin went from Chicago to the University of Indiana. And when in 1945 he came to Los Alamos to conduct again and again the dangerous experiments on the highly unstable uranium-235, it was ticking for all the world to hear.
I thought I'd find you here in the lab, Louis, in all this heat. Tickling the dragon's tail.
Funny stuff, uranium-235. Look, two dull gray lumps. Separate, the small quantities are harmless. Nothing happens. When I push them slowly together.
Yeah.
Careful, Al. Better not come too near.
Yeah.
At some point, we still can't estimate. The mass will become critical and the chain reaction will start.
But why do you have to do this experiment over and over?
In order to attain optimum efficiency in the bomb. The size of the critical mass, the point at which the chain reaction starts, has to be determined under varying conditions.
But you have your calculations. Why do you keep on tickling the dragon's tail?
Our calculations can never be precise, and you know that. Now get your face out of there, Al. At any moment, this can become radioactive. I'll just have to keep on. I'll have to find out for myself.
Yeah, it's better than Russian roulette. How soon will the bomb be assembled?
Yeah, the sooner the better. The target's waiting.
And when the bomb hits?
Nobody knows what'll happen. That's why I want to go along when it's dropped on Japan.
You can't do that. You know they won't let you.
Maybe they will, as a scientific observer.
Have you applied?
Of course.
And they said?
They said no.
Well, then?
I'll keep on pestering them. They have to let me go.
Now, there'll be other observers. You'll see the reports.
I have to find out for myself.
You have to find out for yourself. How many times I've heard that phrase. It'll get you in trouble someday.
Or out of it. Well, the dragon is waiting.
When the authorities did not permit Louis Slotin to accompany the atomic bomb to its targets, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he was depressed for weeks. He continued his research at Los Alamos. Again and again, he tickled the dragon's tail, as the scientists called his dangerous experiment. And three times, the dragon reared up and spat its lethal blue flame at the intrepid men who sought to probe its mysteries. Finally, one of the young scientists fell victim to the silent killer, Harry Daglian, Louis Slotin's friend and laboratory assistant.
I just came back from the hospital, Al.
Well,
Harry doesn't have a chance.
A lethal dose, huh?
Yes. We don't know what a lethal dose is, but whatever LD-50 is, Harry's had it. It's been 3 weeks, and now he's going fast.
Mm. Is it always so slow?
Nobody knows. Well, I have to get back to work.
You're going to do that experiment again?
Of course, I have to.
Now, you know what they're saying. If you keep on doing that experiment, you won't last a year. You're fooling around with something dangerous.
I know, but that's the way it has to be.
Louis Slotin was proud of the fact that he had been chosen to test the criticality of the world's first atomic bombs, the point at which atomic fission would take place within uranium-235. And he was aware of his responsibilities. The Geiger counter ticked louder and faster now, as quietly, steadily, and painstakingly, he continued the experiments that were to prevent another war. The experiments on the bomb that had now become a hope for peace.
Look, Al. Here it is. The receipt.
From Alamogordo?
Yes. For the bomb we delivered there.
It worked.
Everything went according to schedule.
Then you're through now.
With these experiments, yes. I've been ordered to Bikini for the new bomb test.
Good. No more tickling the dragon's tail.
No more. Except, of course, this once. I have to do it again this afternoon for your benefit.
My benefit?
Hmm. So you can carry on.
For the last time, Louis Slotin would approach the dreadful killer and goad him to that point at which he lashed out against the human creatures who dared to tamper with cosmic forces. But in the casual manner of the eight young men who gathered in the laboratory that afternoon of May 21st, 1946, there was no sign of tension, no evidence of the peril they faced together. Eight young men with tanned faces and lean, hard bodies. Eight young men in bright Mexican shirts and cotton slacks. Eight young men with intent faces. A Geiger counter began to tick again as they gathered around to watch. Louis Slotin took the two small lumps of metal, Topsy they lightly called the one, Godiva the other, and deliberately he manipulated them closer and closer together. Why the frivolous title of Godiva? Because the mass was to be allowed to become only barely critical. The amount of nuclear reaction was to be held under control.
Don't you ever use the safety device they gave you after Daglian died?
I don't like it. That thing can cause accidents instead of preventing them. You get to lean on it instead of on your own judgment.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I have a feeling for the experiment now. I'd rather rely on that. Besides...
I know. You have to find out for yourself.
And so, Armed only with his Geiger counter, his neutron monitor, his skill and his courage, Louis Slotin prodded the dragon on to rebellion.
Look, Al. We're almost there. Another fraction of an inch.
Close by his side, peering into the delicate mechanism, stood the man for whose benefit the experiment was being conducted. Around the room, at some distance from the metal table, the other six watched, silent and intent, as Louis Slotin manipulated the guts of an atomic bomb.
We've almost reached the point of criticality. The next eighth of an inch.
And then it happened. Exactly what caused it, we're not told.
Lou! Al, get back!
A strange blue glow was emanating from the machine. A sudden and intense heat filled the room. The red ink line on the neutron monitor disappeared as the instrument was forced right off the scale. The Geiger counter whirred madly. Everyone in the room knew what had happened. A piece of equipment had slipped, the gap between the two pieces of uranium had closed, and the chain reaction had started. The room was filled with deadly radiation.
Lou, quick, the door!
A few feet away, the door stood open, the retreat through which Louis Slotin might have saved himself. But in the split second which followed, he reacted without hesitation. He lunged towards the dragon and tore its jaws apart with his bare hands. The blue glow died down as the two pieces of metal were separated, one from the other. But Louis Slotin had received the full impact of the deadly gamma rays emitted by the nuclear reaction. There was a silence.
Lou, you're all right?
I think so. All of you get out of here.
In a matter of minutes, all eight men were in the Los Alamos Hospital, where expert radiologists treated them with every method known to modern science. The two men who had received the greatest amount of radiation, Louis Slotin and the assistant he had been training to replace him, lay side by side in the same room. His fellow scientist remembers Louis's first words.
I'm sorry I got you into this, Al. I'm afraid I have less than a 50-50 chance. I hope you have better than that.
Radiation, the mysterious killer, works slowly, silently, and strangely.
Oh, I'm much better, Doctor. The nausea is gone. All I feel now is very tired. Do I have a temperature?
Yes, but it's slight.
Well, that's encouraging, isn't it, Doctor?
I think so.
I drew a chart of the lab. It shows exactly where everybody was standing when the accident took place. You'll be able to study the relationship between the amount of exposure and its effect.
In the next few days, Louis Slotin found a new challenge. He had the rare opportunity of studying the effects of atomic radiation on a human guinea pig, himself.
Yes, I've been watching closely, Doctor. My hands, it's very interesting. Yesterday, the left became swollen and red in just 3 hours. Sort of bluish under the nails. I guess you have that?
Yes.
But now both hands are affected. And see, the left is blistered.
Is it painful?
Fairly. What's that you're doing, nurse?
Packing your hands in ice.
It should relieve the pain and swelling.
My abdomen feels tender.
Uh-huh. Swollen.
Say, Al, strange the way the human body reacts to nuclear radiation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Symptoms pop up unexpectedly. Never thought I'd see it.
That's right, Lou. Now you can find out for yourself.
Hello? Just a minute. Dr. Slotin, it's your call. Here, I'll hold the phone for you.
Thank you. Hello, Papa, this is Louis. How are you? Well, Papa, there's been a slight accident, and I may be here for some time. Well, could you fly down to see me? The Army will send a special plane for you.
Louis, what is it? You're all right?
Nothing to get excited about, Mother. A few burns.
Burns? What happened?
A little radiation. We don't know how much. There's no reason to be alarmed.
You look all right.
I feel fine. Remarkably well.
Your hands.
They're packed in ice, Mother.
What is it with your hair, Louis? It looks different.
It's a little bit stiff. That's natural after exposure to nuclear radiation. Oh, Mama, Papa, I want you to meet my doctor. Doctor, these are my parents, Mr. and Mrs. Albert Slotin.
How do you do?
How do you do? I'm proud to meet Louis Slotin's parents.
This is only one of the doctors, Mama. You should see, there have been 10 of them already, a whole army of doctors marching in and out of here every day. The United States Army really does right by us.
Yeah, the United States Army has reason to. Mr. Slotin, has Louis showed you the letter he received from Major General Groves?
No. Where is it, Louis?
It's right there.
Listen, Mama, what he says. I have nothing but admiration for your heroic actions. Your quick reaction and disregard for the danger to yourself undoubtedly prevented a much more serious accident.
Papa, I want you to meet the fellow who's going to take over my work when I go to Bikini. He was exposed, too. He was standing right next to me. But he's coming along very nicely. I think he's going to be okay.
Louis, I don't understand. Please explain to me.
Favus brechst du dein Zung. Mama, why don't you speak Yiddish? I have a new complaint today, Doctor. My tongue is sore.
Let's see. Yeah. There's a small whitish ulceration on your tongue.
Well, that's unexpected, isn't it? In 5 days?
Open your mouth again, Louis. I have my own research to do. Now, the ulceration is opposite a filled tooth.
It's a gold inlay. The gold must be radioactive.
We'll have it capped immediately. Nurse?
Louis, is that bad about the tooth?
Now, didn't you hear, Mama? They're going to cap it right away. It'll be
Doctor,
okay.
What does that mean?
A bad sign, nurse.
Doctor, his pulse. It's rising very rapidly.
You have the laboratory report?
Yes, here it is. The blood count.
It's falling. The white blood cells are not reproducing themselves. I'm afraid we know now. The dose was more than LD-50.
Louis. Louis, don't you recognize me?
Doctor, what is it? He's asleep.
He's in a coma.
He'll come out of this coma. He will. Won't he, Doctor?
I'm afraid not.
And on the ninth day, Louis Slotin, aged 35, quietly died. The sun, source of life, can also be the source of death. Louis Slotin's body had been drenched with 880 rentgens of nuclear radiation. The effect was the same as if he had been exposed to an atomic bomb explosion at a distance of 4,800 feet. For Louis Alexander Slotin, the Geiger counter had stopped ticking. The other seven men lived. Many earnest and thoughtful words have been spoken about Louis Slotin by those who knew him. His friend and fellow scientist says,
"It is unquestionably true that I, and perhaps others of those present, owe our lives to his action. I do not know whether this is heroism. I suspect that Louis would have objected to such a term."
From where comes such a man? How does a human creature learn to value other lives more than his own? From where comes the choice, made in the fraction of a second, unhesitatingly, unerringly, the choice of dying that others may live?
Only he is master of himself who lives for God and men. He is free from the power of sorrow, free from the oppressor's yoke. Free from death.
If you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 10 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. Now we take great pleasure in presenting Mr. Samuel Friedland, prominent national lay leader and member of the Board of Overseers of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Mr. Friedland.
Today is Memorial Day. Today we pause to remember those who gave their lives for fellow men. This is the meaning of the life of Louis Slotin, whose story you have just heard. Louis Slotin was well aware, as but few of us can be, for the terribly destructive nature of atomic warfare. And yet, this knowledge did not fill him with a paralyzing fear, but served rather as a continuing source of inner strength. This love of humanity he derived from the tradition of his father. I have met many people who, in the course of life's normal pursuit, literally die many deaths each day, plagued by a host of fears. It is because they do not see themselves as part of the future. They live only in the present. Oddly enough, Louis Slotin, who lived in the death's own shadow, carried on as if it did not exist for him, fortified with the inner strength that comes from an overarching faith which sees man as part of God's eternal plan. He saw death as a normal act of divine providence. He was able to see life as a meaningful unity because he was deeply rooted in the sense of religious values flowing from the experience and training of early youth. From these, he derived spiritual sustenance and courage, which lent dignity to his life and meaning to his death. On this Memorial Day, we join together in prayer for many of our young people who gave their lives, as did Louis Slotin, some in time of war, others in time of peace, so that we might be spared a similar sacrifice. Our only consolation at this hour is the reassuring recognition that their sense of moral responsibility may be increasingly shared by all of humankind. Their sacrifice may make possible the future of the highest ideals we profess. Today, we renew our faith in the promise of the youth of the world, in the Louis Slotins of the world. This is our faith, as it is our hope.
Thank you, Mr. Friedland. Our eternal eye drama today, The Dragon's Tale, was written by Hannah Grad Goodman, was presented in honor of Memorial Day. Cantor David Putterman sang the liturgical introduction. Featured in the cast were Leon Janney as Louis Slotin and Alexander Skorby as the narrator. Others in our cast were Peter Capel, Ethel Everett, David Pfeffer, Nelson Umstead, Edwin Jerome, Bert Cowlin, and Sylvia Davis. The music was written by Morris Momorsky and conducted by Milton Katims. This has been an NBC Radio Network production under the direction of Edward King. This is Mel Brand speaking. This is the NBC Radio Network.